Okay, so we have exam two coming up next week. Be in here. You're allowed a 3.5 by 5 inch index card with anything you want written on it. Bring a calculator. I guess there's de Broglie's wavelength thing we could do a calculation on, but I mean, it's not clear to me that you'll have a use for the calculator, but you should bring it just in case. This will cover recitations 5 through 10, so that's through this week to talking about inflation, and starting basically with de Broglie. And let's see, so recitation 9 from last Friday we didn't have, so Thursday at 4:30 in Bausch & Lomb 208, there'll be a makeup for that. And recognizing that not everybody can make that, the hope is anyone who can't make that can go to the regular recitation on Friday. And Adam, I think, will spend some time on that material afterwards. Yes?
So you're saying just for the exam, you have inflation. Does that include some of the multiverse theories?
Yeah, I mean, it includes... the cyclic Big Bang, the beyond the horizon, and the bubble multiverse, because those are the cyclic Big Bang, because it's pretty it's basically Big Bang. It's out of fashion, but it's a Big Bang idea. Then the beyond the horizon and the bubble multiverse basically just come out of inflation, so that's sort of part of the inflationary idea. Although I will have to think about that. If I want to ask you much about those multiverse ideas, I'll have to go and look and see what we did in recitation 10 to remind myself of how fair it would be to ask you guys questions. Because if I forgot to say anything about that in recitation 10, then you, in principle, haven't had a chance to sort of talk about those ideas together, and so that wouldn't be too fair. So I'll have to, so with that caveat, so let me go back and look. Monday, this coming Monday, class will be just an open question and answer session. So I'll just simply try to respond to any kinds of questions you have, clarify anything you might have questions about for the exam. I mean, there is, of course, a tremendous amount of crap in there. I understand that. Again, I understand you might be nervous about how it translates to a grade. I'm trying to figure out how to do that easily in a reasonable way. The course is supposed to be fun. I mean, I understand there's a lot of stuff. The idea is we're covering a lot of stuff so that we can talk about these really weird things. And so I don't know how to get around that. So I hope, I just try to have fun with it. I mean, that's the whole point. And also next week we won't have recitations because we've got the exam and a Q&A session, and so it doesn't make much sense. And I'll have to think about what to do with the reading. I may put up reading for next week, which basically, you know, I may put up a reading assignment that basically works for the next 2 weeks or something, if I think about that over the weekend. Yeah. I have to look at the calendar, but yeah, we're almost out of class time. There won't be but one or two classes after the exam, and I forget how many. Maybe only one. I think there are two. Yeah, we're getting there.
And we won't have recitation on any of that information.
I don't know how we'll play that yet. I mean, I can't formally schedule recitations into the reading period. On the other hand, it'd be nice to have a chance to chat about some of the ideas that we may be talking about, so I'll have to think about that. I'll try to figure a way to do that in a fair way. I mean, I don't know what to say at this point. I mean, at the very least, I would send out something like a recitation set of questions to focus your thinking, and then if we can't schedule a recitation, maybe I'll accompany that with something like a written guide to what I think about those questions or something, just to give you some idea. I mean, I don't know yet what I do with that. Anything else on? Okay. Okay, so last time we started talking about string theory, which I think maybe when we started it should have seemed very disjoint, sort of a bit of a transition from the Big Bang, inflation, and some of the multiverse ideas we were talking about. But there is some method to my madness, because it turns out that many of the ideas that we're talking about actually have a home in the ideas that are coming out of string theory. So I want to review a little bit what we talked about last time in terms of what string theory is all about, and then we'll talk about how that ties in with the whole multiverse idea. Let me maybe chat for just a minute about this whole idea of string theory. This is really science at work. As we'll see, and as we talked about last time, there are some reasons for theorists to be very excited about the ideas about string theory, and many of them, particularly in two periods, once in the 80s and once in the 90s, many of the most aspiring young theorists in physics jumped into the area and have become string theorists. And in fact, the period in 85 was called the first string revolution, and the one in 90s was called the second string revolution, because of breakthroughs that made it look really promising as a potential way to move beyond what we know about the standard model, solve many of the current theoretical problems, and if you want to be really arrogant, think about it has all the characteristics of creating a framework for a theory of everything, in that it includes the pieces that we know are missing if you wanted to actually create a theory of everything. So there's been a lot of excitement about string theory. That said, there is no string theory that makes a solid, that can even give us a spectrum of the particles we have now. There is no string theory that even basically underlies the standard model as of yet. So we don't, much less making hard predictions of things we can go look for and then find evidence to support the string theory. So up till now, string theory really has been a lot of mathematical exercises. So in a sense, if you were to go and talk about string theory in a physics department, you'll find many physicists sitting there very excited about some of the ideas. Yes, it's promising, we should have a string theorist as part of the department. And you'll find many physicists who will look at it and go, whoop, what have they done? I mean, what have they shown us? There's not a theory yet. And there's actually a lot of truth to both ideas. One of the interesting things to me personally that has come out of this is that it's sort of funny. Sometimes it doesn't really matter what the reason is. But if you get a lot of bright people in a room and they start arguing, something cool comes out of it usually. So whether string theory ever ends up being a formalism that can give us a theory of everything, it has begun to be, there are techniques that have been developed in string theory that now are complementary to the more standard theoretical techniques we have in quantum field theory and everything. So regardless of whether we ever do get a theory of everything, it's like this new area has now developed theoretical techniques that are actually useful even in more conventional quantum field theory and things like that. There are ways in which it's become a fairly useful thing. So what will happen? Who knows? So a lot of what I'm talking about now is to give you some of the reasons people are excited about it, and how it ties into the multiverse in a very core way, and then some of the implications of that. Whether string theory sort of becomes non-fad, you know, the fad passes, and it sort of becomes a specialty area where people do some small calculations on things. I mean, who knows? But it's certainly been an interesting area where the some of the most mathematical and talented theoretical physicists have gone in the last 20, 30 years. So it's fun. At any rate, the whole idea in string theory is really, at the core, very simple idea. Instead of treating particles as points in a theory, you treat them as sort of extended like objects, and that you, instead of having points with different masses effectively, you basically take these extended objects, which could be open or closed strings, and you look at the different excitations on the strings, and the thing to keep in mind would be the standing wave excitations that we saw earlier in the semester. So if you vibrate a string and there's a reflected wave, for certain values of the vibration, you'll actually get standing waves. So you'll get this resonant wave, and very similar to music. Well, energy and mass are the same thing. So if we talk about different energy excitations, that can, in the theory, sort of be manifest in terms of, in the real world, as different mass particles. So that's basically the idea. So it turns out that the mathematics used to describe excitations of these different strings, when made relativistic, actually can be identified with the mathematics used to identify particles in quantum field theory. So there's a correspondence in terms of the ability to, so people can talk about these excitations and be discussing a particle spectrum, and so that's the basic idea. And there are a number of reasons to be very excited about it. One is that in quantum field theory, when you're talking about sort of point-like particles, when an interaction happens, it basically happens at a point, which means the particle, the distance between them goes to zero, and there are mathematical things that depend on this distance, effectively. And so there, when you have these sort of small distance interactions, the mathematics can go crazy. So this, for example, is one of the reasons, one of the things that gives you a lot of trouble when you try to throw something that has the characteristics of a graviton. So if you try to do quantum gravity in quantum field theory, you run into deep trouble with this kind of thing. Mathematics goes wacko. So one way around that, if you think about it, instead of a point-like particle traveling along these paths, these two point-like particles coming together and interacting, becoming this one, but this all happens at a point, imagine two particles that look like strings, and they trace out this and this, and they interact. And now you can sort of imagine it tracing out this tube and that tube, and they basically come together and now trace out a bigger tube. There's no point at which the radius goes to zero or the distance between them goes to zero. So the mathematics in this graphical sort of sense is much better behaved. So the small distance behavior problem is solved. Another thing which was discovered quite by accident, it just turned out to be the case, when people looked at the possible excitations on these strings, they got particles that had characteristics that didn't correspond to things that we have in everyday life. And one of them turns out to have the characteristics of the graviton. So initially, this was a problem because that wasn't really what they were trying to do with the theory. But then later on, they realized, whoa, maybe we can use this to do quantum gravity. So, in fact, there is the potential. It turns out that quantum field theory and gravitation are fundamentally really hard to marry together, but in string theory, that marriage appears to happen naturally. So it seems to be a framework where there's great potential to be able to build a theory of quantum gravity. So people were very excited about that. Another thing that comes naturally in string theory is the idea of supersymmetry. And this is something I've mentioned a few times. I know it must seem really, really strange when you first see it. Well, okay, I saw it for the first time too, so it was pretty strange when I saw it. So I understand that. The idea with supersymmetry, physicists are compulsive and sort of really hung up on symmetries. It turns out that that if there's a symmetry in nature that you can recognize, very often there's when you translate that into mathematics, you come up with a conservation law, which is very useful in physics. So there are lots of good reasons for physicists technically to be very excited about any sort of symmetry that they can imagine in nature. Nature just happens to throw at us, in the spectrum of particles that we can observe, which I've put a few of them here in green. So, for example, quarks and electron neutrino and the electron, and you've seen the particles in the standard model that we listed, so basically it would be all of those. If you look at that list, they come with two different types of spin. There's those with half integral spin, like the electron and the quarks, and there are those which have zero or integral spin. The ones with the half integral spin are known as fermions, and the ones with zero or integral spin are known as bosons. And in the theories, they behave a little bit differently. So, for example, we have talked a little bit about radiative. I don't know. Did I talk about radiative corrections? If you imagine a particle here and a particle here interacting, and forget this loop for a moment, they just interact. This would be basically a Feynman diagram describing the quantum field theory view of how a force works. So the particle that's exchanged here would be a gauge boson, like a photon or a Z or a W or something. So if it were a photon, it'd be the electromagnetic force. So we've sort of seen those pictures. Remember that in quantum theory, any particle could basically, it could have virtual particles that can exist for a short period of time, and so long as things come back together in a short period of time, this is a possibility. Which means when you do a calculation of this interaction, you also have to include the possibility of virtual loops of particles in here. Physicists call those radiative corrections. And it turns out that in some instances in standard quantum field theory, these radiative corrections can get out of control with the particles that we know. And one way to solve that problem is to say, well, suppose there were a particle that's identical to this, except its spin differs by a bit. So if instead of a one-half spin electron, we had a zero spin electron, and it had the same mass, well, or it was identical in every other way, basically. If that were the case, it turns out that spin zero particles, when you put them in a loop here, it comes in with the opposite sign. So if there were a deep symmetry in nature between fermions and bosons, such that for every fermion there was a boson, and for every boson that we see as a normal particle there's a fermion, then the radiative corrections would all basically cancel out exactly. So that turns out to be a really nice thing for the theorists. So they like this idea of supersymmetry. The other thing is, well, if you have the idea of fermions and bosons, why does nature choose to have, say, more fermions than bosons? Why not have a symmetry between them? So the idea is that there is this supersymmetry, which says for every normal particle that we've discussed up till now, there exists a supersymmetric partner where the spin is different, but everything else is the same. And then you say, well, why don't we see them? Because we see electrons. If we have something that's identical to an electron except it has spin zero, why don't we see it? And the idea is that there is something in nature that breaks the symmetry slightly such that these particles turn out to be very heavy. So heavy that they don't exist in normal everyday life. But in particle accelerators, people are looking at things at tremendous energies, and they're actually looking to see if we can create some of these particles. And if they do, you'll hear all about it because it'll be big news. Yeah. Okay, so it does sort of all tie together. I was sort of deliberately avoiding that subtle point. It turns out that in these theories, generally speaking, if I have a heavy supersymmetric particle, when it decays, it will have to decay into a supersymmetric particle and a normal particle. This tilde, which sort of in a sense, as physicists would say, it's a quantum number that says it's a supersymmetric particle. It gets conserved in most of these theories, which means if I'm a supersymmetric particle, I can only decay into something that also, somehow, the net stuff that I decay into must also include a supersymmetric particle. What that means is that if these all happen to be heavier in mass, the lightest one of those is stable. If that lightest particle is stable and neutral, it could be dark matter. It could be the particle which gives us all this mass, which doesn't interact with anything except gravitationally. In fact, that is sort of the leading theoretical candidate for dark matter. So, yes. So, that could very well be. The other thing is there are particles here that can do exactly what the Higgs does in the Standard Model. So if you're a theoretical physicist, I mean, when I was in graduate school, in fact, I think if you've read some early chapter in the book, I think I tell this story. I remember sitting in some quantum field theory class with my professor sitting there, and he was writing on the board and started talking about supersymmetry, and he turned around. He was just shaking. He was so excited, and he says, It's just got to be true because it's so beautiful, you know. And one of the reasons it's beautiful, and it's even more beautiful than he knew at the time, because we didn't even know about dark matter at the time, and now it's one of the most compelling things behind dark matter. But it can solve the Higgs problem. It's a beautiful symmetry in and of itself mathematically. It can help with many theoretical questions. It can solve dark matter. It can be the Higgs. So there are lots of reasons people are sort of excited about supersymmetry. Okay, that said, if you do string theory, the initial string theories that were done basically just included bosons, and it doesn't really matter what I'm saying here. The world includes fermions. So that simply cannot turn into a theory that works in nature. It turns out that if you're going to create a string theory that has both fermions and bosons, in order to make it such that you don't have a lot of spurious particles that don't exist in nature, which they call ghost particles. Basically, there are misbehaviors in the theory unless it happens to be supersymmetric. So you hypothesize bosons and fermions, and that for every boson there's a type of fermion, and you do it in 10 dimensions. So one of the things that comes out of this is a good thing in that there are lots of reasons to believe supersymmetry is very compelling, and it just falls out naturally here in a theory that's fairly well behaved. So string theory sort of naturally gives you supersymmetry. Again, a very big reason to be excited about string theory. The bad thing that comes out of it is you really have to do it in 10 dimensions, which we don't live in 10 dimensions. So that's the big problem with string theory. So what do we do with all these extra dimensions? And basically, if it's mathematics, you don't care. because you can do mathematics in n dimensions and it doesn't matter. If you're constrained to try to be a physicist, I mean, physics is much harder than mathematics in some ways because you're constrained to try to actually... that you're constrained by observation. We clearly live in three dimensions plus time, so a 10-dimensional theory is complete garbage. But what does that really mean? What it means is that when you construct the theory, you have to construct it so that six of those dimensions are not perceptible to you by any experiment that we have done to date. That is not to say it will never be something we could detect. It just means down to certain distance scale, which we have probed, we do not see evidence for the extra dimensions. So how can you do that? Mathematically, it turns out there are a couple of ways to try to do this. One is called compactification, and another, there's probably a technical term for it, but I couldn't remember it. Basically, you limit where the particles can go, and what that means, I'll show you in a minute. Compactification, though. This is a simple example. I think you can do things much more complex, especially if you're trying to do it with many dimensions, and that will become a theme of the second half of this lecture. But imagine that you have, for example, a two-dimensional object, so like a sheet. You can take the ends of the sheet, roll them together, and then you get something like this. This is now sort of a three-dimensional object that's characterized by this parameter r. If you allow r to become very, very small, you get a one-dimensional object from what you can see. So imagine this looks like a hair, this looks like a sheet of paper. If we take a microscope, and we look at it really closely, this hair can become like this, okay? So it's not to say the dimension truly disappeared. It just means we can't see it. You okay with this? So imagine if you're doing six dimensions instead of two. I'm not an expert on this. I'm not even an amateur on that. But there are many ways in which you can topologically play this game. And when you're doing multiple dimensions, you get many different parameters. And within these theories, those parameters can be identified with physical constants of nature. So if we were to take six dimensions of space-time and sort of curl them up in different ways, we actually might get different physical constants in nature. So different strengths of forces, different things like electric charges and things like this. So this compactification is a very powerful thing in principle. So in principle, the extra dimensions isn't something that should stop us. It can even be very, very liberating. I guess the last 20 years now, so in the 1990s, it was discovered that there are other types of structures that you can put in string theories. You don't have to limit yourself to simple strings. So it turns out that these really are geometric theories that are built of many different types of objects. So this corresponds to the dimensionality of the type of object. And so in a more general sense, instead of talking about point strings, membranes, we talk about zero brains, one brains, two brains, three brains, etc. And now you can have objects of, as say, nine dimensions in this nine or ten dimensional theory. So you get strange words like D brains and P brains and stuff like that. So once you have these objects, they can interact with each other, and you can make up rules for how they can interact with one another. So one of the things that they've come up with is a pretty bizarre idea that certain types of strings, like open string solutions, are actually tied to, for example, you could imagine, all right, let me start over. If you have objects of different dimensionality in a string theory, you can try to marry them together with different rules. So let's look at what can happen. One of the things that people talk about are, say, open strings where the ends of the string are basically stuck in objects of a certain type. So you can have a three-dimensional space, which is called the three brain, so that would be like what we live in, where particles which have open strings effectively have the ends of their strings stuck in that three space. This three brain might be embedded in yet another dimension where those strings are not allowed to actually go. If we are made up and what we perceive is made up of particles which correspond to strings like this, they are confined to the three dimensions in which we live. So that is all that we can experience. We talked way long ago about the strengths of the different forces. And of the four forces of nature, gravitation is the one that seems anomalous, actually. Even though it's the one that's ever present in our lives, if we look at the strength of the strong force, the weak force, and the electromagnetic force, they're all roughly equal at a level of about a part in 10,000. I mean, they're sort of fairly strong. Gravitation is something like 10 to the 40th times weaker than the strong force. It's anomalously weak. So one of the ways that people have pondered this would be gravitons happen to be closed strings like this. And in this strange sort of theory, the graviton can actually move in this other dimension. So in this theory, you could have gravity basically having the same strength as the other forces, but the gravitational strength basically has to get distributed into the extra dimensions, and this effectively weakens the gravity that we see in our three brain. And that's one way of fabricating a thought as to why gravity is very weak. So it's a little bit of a strange thing, but basically gravity may leak into this other 11th dimension, and there might be other brains which can basically interact with that gravity potentially, but the open strings are stuck on that brain. So that's sort of this idea. And note that we actually have a dimension which is quite big, but by construction of where these particles can go, it is not something we can perceive directly. So again, it satisfies the constraint of allowing for the extra dimension, but not making it so that we can see it. Yeah.
So the string that's attached to the brain means that you can't observe that string?
No, it means that if it's attached to this brain and this is the three brain where we sort of live, it means that that particle is constrained to be in this three-dimensional space, which is our brain. But there could be some extra dimension where some other particle that wasn't an open type might actually pass. And that's the idea that the graviton is able to pass and maybe some other particles can pass through. I think we still think about time in the same way. Sort of, in a sense, you can imagine time as some other dimension that where this is, whatever is happening here at this moment, you then characterize it at another moment. Time is the fabric with which you do that characterization, I guess. I mean, having said that, time and space get a little bit twisted together with all relativistic effects, so we have to worry about that. No, time. No, I wouldn't think about this. This isn't our three brain a while ago and here it is now. These are all now. They're separated in this 11th dimension, whatever it is. But you could have time here and time here all happening. You could even sort of imagine stepping out if you could perceive all these dimensions and have sort of a semi-absolute time sort of happening. But time's a little bit weird because wherever I have, for example, a lot of energy, it can distort the space and the time in that region. So let's see. Time often is thought of as being given by the direction of increasing entropy, where entropy is sort of a measure of disorder. And so I think in all these things that would continue to be the case. So maybe that particular idea will become a little clearer as we talk about the next multiverse here, actually. All right. This is a string theory concept with brains. In principle, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with a multiverse. You could potentially think of this as an explanation for dark matter. If, say, these two, three brains were really close to one another, and this is the one in which we live, and we have a whole lot of mass right here in the other three brain, gravity can sort of leak from one to the other, so it's possible. I think people have thought a little bit about that. I don't know if there's a really workable theory with that. It's not, I mean, there may be, but I don't know of it. This is sort of a standalone string theory idea. There is a cosmology that has come out which actually makes use of these ideas. It avoids inflation. So this is very significant. It also has the potential of reproducing the fluctuations that we see in the cosmic microwave background and potentially, I mean, all the other characteristics out of the Big Bang. So it's a very interesting idea that is being pushed in particular by Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok. It is something I think I talk a lot about in my book on Chapter 8. And if you have an interest in this, they've actually written a very nice book called Endless Universe, which is referenced in my book, and so definitely might have fun picking that up and reading it. That book talks a lot about inflationary cosmology and then string theory, and then this universe is sort of what they're leading up to. So what is this universe? The idea is you have two, three brains separated in the bulk, which is this 11th dimension. Three brains means these are three-dimensional realities like what we live in, where there are other six dimensions in the theory. So string theory is thought to be, we talked about 10 dimensions. There were a number of different 10-dimensional theories that are self-consistent and seemed okay. And Edward Witten in the 90s realized that these were all sort of special cases of what would likely be an 11-dimensional theory. So now the idea is that string theory, that the theory of everything, if you could create it, would, they call it M theory, is 11 dimensions. So what we would have is a three-dimensional brain. Then six dimensions get compactified so we don't perceive them, and then there might be this 11th dimension that the brain basically can move in, which we don't perceive because our particles are stuck on our three brain. So that's the basic idea. What Turok and Steinhardt asked is, God, what would happen if you had multiple three brains wafting around in the bulk? What would happen if they collided, for example? And this led them to a very interesting model, because what they found was when they would collide, they actually would generate a lot of energy within there. So we could have another three brain, so you can think of it as another three-dimensional reality that is slightly offset from ours. It overlaps, but it's offset in a different dimension, which we cannot perceive because our particles can't get through that bit. Yeah. No, you've got the look of a bubbling question there.
So brains are dimensions, or the dimensions are independent of brains?
Brains are structures that are categorized by how many dimensions they have. So something with zero dimensions is a point. Something with one dimension is like a string. Something with two dimensions is like a plane of paper, a membrane. Something that's three-dimensional, and then you mathematically can go on up. It's just our brain, our B-R-A-I-N, just can't imagine it.
So within each brain, there are multiple dimensions. And so I just don't understand, like, I can't conceptualize this.
Okay, well, you're not alone, so don't feel bad. All right, I'm speaking as a non-expert, so I'm simply giving you the flavor that I have of it. So mathematically, you can have structures that have different dimensionality within the string theory. The idea, though, is eventually to try to create something that mimics reality. You want to make a physical theory. So in order for it to mimic reality, you have to have a three-dimensional reality in which normal particles can exist so that we can create a reality like we observe. So that means we have to have the four forces that we know about that have to exist in that three-dimensional reality, and the particles that we're made of have to exist in that three-dimensional reality. In the string theory, those particles are described as little one-dimensional objects that are vibrating, and they can be closed or they can be open. And I think this idea is that the ones that are open little strings are confined to a three-dimensional structure, which is why we only live in three dimensions and we only perceive three dimensions. In principle, you could imagine particles that are not confined, so it turns out the graviton is a closed particle, and it might actually waft into some other dimension, which we call the bulk, that our three-dimensional reality happens to be embedded in. We can't perceive that additional dimension because the particles we perceive, except for gravity, have nothing to do with that other dimension. And the fact that the gravity particles bleed into the other dimension is basically why gravity is so weak relative to the other forces. But it still doesn't really give us an ability to see that other dimension in principle, at least not that we've understood yet. Did that help?
Yeah, somewhat.
Okay. Once you allow this picture to happen, you can hypothesize other structures, like another three brain, which you could imagine as a reality like we have, which is actually separated from our reality in this other dimension. We can't see it because no photon can leave our three-dimensional brain and travel to that and come back to us or anything.
Would
and
it be really far away, or it sits right on top of it?
It could be. It could be very close to us. It could be offset only a slight amount. And people may actually have reasons to know this. The number that comes to my mind is a very small number. So it could be slightly offset from us, but it's in another dimension, which we don't see. So I can't tell you it's that way or this way. It's in another dimension, sort of, is this picture. So we don't perceive it directly.
But with the same number.
Hmm?
With the same number of dimensions. It's separated by a dimension, but actually has the same number. The actual brain has the same number of dimensions.
Yeah, the theory is that the 11th dimension is this bulk, which means these structures would have to somehow within them have 10 dimensions. And so the way I was thinking about it is you have three dimensions that are sort of large, so that's why we seem to live in a three-dimensional reality, and then you have six dimensions that are compactified. I don't know, theoretically, within some theory for things to be self-consistent, whether that compactification has to be the same in each of the structures. So if there's another three brain, does it mean that the compactification has to be the same? I do not know. I don't know. Yeah.
Can there be multiple, like, three or more three brains, or is there only one three because...
I don't know what the limitations are as to what the structures that you can put into the bulk happen to be. And there may be some limitations. What I will say is that my understanding of this particular model is that you basically have this 11th dimension, and I don't recall now whether these two, three brains border this 11th dimension, so that you sort of have this degree of freedom, but nothing sort of beyond that, or whether it's sort of some big reality 11th dimension that they can just waft in. I sort of got the picture of something wafting. So if you'll just bear with me for a moment, let us suppose, and if you want, you can think of this other brain as being a reality very much like ours, although I haven't done the theory, so I don't know that it is constrained to be like ours. If the compactification is done differently for that one, then the physical laws will be a bit different there. But if I were writing the theory the first time, I would probably make it just like ours to see what happens, and whether they're constrained to do that or not, I don't know. Huh?
Your screensaver?
Yeah. What about it?
Can we see that your drawing?
My drawings. Which drawing? Oh, yeah, we can do that. There, sorry. Okay, so what they say in this theory is, if you suppose we have two, three brains that are offset a little bit in an 11th dimension, and they hypothesize the existence of a spring-like force between these two, so that basically there's a cycle where they collide, get blown apart, slow down, and come back together. So they have a cycle where the three brains are basically doing this. So you can, if we were to look at two-dimensional surfaces, like two sheets of paper, embedded in three dimensions, so they're able to move in this third dimension, you can imagine having two sheets of paper that collide, move apart, and come back together. So there's some sort of a force that causes them to do this, okay? So they hypothesize this. There's no evidence such a force really exists, okay? This is something that they put into their model ad hoc. Imagine, I mean, we have to start the cycle somewhere. So let us imagine that we have two completely smooth three brains of space and time, okay? And let us suppose, to create such a thing, that we have this accelerating expansion that we see in our universe. If we wait a trillion years, this accelerating expansion will be causing the space in our universe to expand to the point that basically, you know, all the galaxies that we can see will have moved outside of our observable universe. And under those circumstances, you can basically see our three brain as being just smooth space-time, because there just won't be other stuff out there. It'll all be spread so thin you can approximate it as smooth three-dimensional space-time. So imagine these two pieces coming together. It turns out that you will always have little quantum fluctuations in that structure, and there is an attraction, there is a force of attraction that depends on the distance between these brains and their theory. So if you have little quantum fluctuations, you'll have regions where you get slightly more attraction than others. So what will happen is, as the three brains get close to one another, they'll sort of begin to wrinkle a little bit. Some places will get attracted a little bit more than others. And then if they're wrinkled, so where we are is sort of, they're moving together. As they move together, you'll begin to form wrinkles in the space-time. So we start out very smooth. I mean, you might have a galaxy here, but basically things are very smooth. As they come together, you begin to get wrinkles because they affect one another. And now, some of those bits of wrinkles begin to collide before other parts do. When they collide, energy is released, and those parts begin to move apart. So they don't really stick together. It's like they collide, energy is released, and then they begin to move apart. But since this happens in an uneven way, you get a distribution of energy, which you would see in, which would manifest itself as different temperature regions within the three brain, which, when they calculate the structure of these wrinkles, they can come up with something that would look exactly like the pattern that we see of the energy distribution in the cosmic microwave background. So the picture is that when things collide, basically we have this large three-dimensional reality, much larger than our observable universe, where everywhere at once, in this wrinkly sort of way, so not exactly at once, but you get an energy deposition that happens, and then the two, three brains begin to move away. And when they do that, they basically are creating the conditions of the start of the Big Bang throughout this three-dimensional reality all at one time. Yeah?
What's an energy deposition?
Think of it sort of as an explosion, where the two, three brains meet. Energy is distributed within the space where they're colliding. That energy can take the form of radiation and particles, so it becomes like the soup of subatomic particles at the start of the Big Bang. But instead of happening in a small region that then expands, it's happening in a full three-dimensional reality that's much larger than what we see, what we always think of as the Big Bang. So there's no inflation. The universe is already big, or the reality is already big. And all of a sudden, when these three brains collide, you basically get, you go from something that's quiescent and dark and cool to energy everywhere, which can be like a subatomic soup, which then the space-time might expand because the equations of general relativity are still true. So this space within the three brain can still be expanding in that three dimensions. And so you can have this subatomic soup and then this expanding three-dimensional reality, which will cool the subatomic soup, condense into stars and galaxies. As the two three brains move away from one another, you can actually form the reality so that things look a lot like what we see now. So from here to here would be the 13.7 billion years since the Big Bang. And as we look back in time, we'd just be seeing the evolution of this energy into what we see today. Within each of these three brains, the space might be expanding, and the two three brains are basically just moving apart as the space inside them expands and they cool down. And then in this weird mechanism that they put in the book, they basically have this ad hoc force they add in the theory that causes this, when they collide, there's a big force that moves them apart, but then it's sort of a spring-like force, such as they move apart, they slow down, and then begin to come back together. And this time is a very large time. So it's 13.7 billion years to this point, but it will actually continue to go so that they become very smooth. And then they'll begin to come back together and you start the cycle again. And so they end up with a cyclic cosmology. Epicuriotic, they were looking... Epicuriotic, I think it's actually... Epicuriotic, yeah. They were looking for a name for this weird universe, and they talked to... It's a story in my book. They talked to... some friends of theirs, classics people, who said, oh, this is like the old idea of birth from fire, which is basically what epicuriotic means. And so one of the inventors of the theory said, wow, it sounds a bit like a disease. But they decided to stick with the name. So it, to me, is like you have a universe... and you go through this cycle. So it's a cyclic universe. So the different universes are separated in time, but it's a multiple universe idea. Yeah.
So all the energy in our universe is caused by interactions between quantum fluctuations between these brains.
It's caused by the brain collisions,
and,
yeah.
And so then we get more volume in our universe as they overlap more, and we get less as they come apart again. If the wrinkles smooth out, then there'd be less energy in the space.
Think of the three spaces as sort of independent things.
Correct.
And so we have a general relativity solution to this three space. So we can have expanding space happening in this three-dimensional brain,
right,
as is, independent of what's going on in the bulk. But as you have the space-time of the different bulks hit one another, I'm sorry, the different brains hit one another, then you get a big energy release throughout the bulk. So it's everywhere at once.
Oh, so
except for not exactly at once, because, you know, some spots hit slightly before other spots because of the wrinkling of the structure of the brain. That's how they get their fluctuations.
So that when you say energy deposition, that it's caused by the interactions between...
It's caused by the interactions of the two brains, but I can't tell you what really does that, and I can't tell you how energy is sort of somehow ultimately conserved in the whole picture. Yeah, so if Steinhardt or Turok comes here to give a colloquium, I want you to get in the back and ask them. Yeah, because I don't recall really. I mean, their book Endless Universe is very good, but of course it's not technical, and that's, I don't know what the technical answer is to that. I haven't done the theory. Yeah. I don't know. You tell me.
How much of this every unit have to reproduce on the
Oh man. You need to tell me where the brains came from. She's not amused.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I understand. I don't know. I'm not expecting you to be super comfortable with all the details of this stuff. I mean, I'm hoping you'll read some of the stuff that I have asked you to read, and I understand what I've told you, but
So the dimensions don't necessarily have to be flat. They can be like big, massive bunches too, right?
They can be curved and wrinkled and...
So it just, I don't know, but to me it just sounds like space is just what is, there's just an infinite possibility of what existence is.
And this it's is even going to get worse, because as you go up to many dimensions, I mean, in straight general relativity, in three dimensions plus time, space becomes more of a fabric that can be distorted, and so I mean that's how you view gravity. In string theory, it gets even worse because we have all these other dimensions that have to disappear by compactification, and there are about 10 to the 500 different ways of doing that.
And that's just all that we know about right now. So it could be 10 to the million.
Well, that's a total. That's just an estimate that the 10 to the 500. Yeah. So that's based on. I don't even know how good the estimate is. I've seen slightly different numbers, but it's a huge number of possibilities.
Is this based on math, or is this just like a theory that's like not based on math? Because I know that like a lot of theories just kind of exist before they're proven, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's kind of like...
Okay, so there are different ways, different levels of answering that, okay? Yes, this is based on math. Does it correspond to reality? Is it sort of based on math but made up at this point, and we're exploring all the parameters of the ideas and seeing what it predicts and refining it, maybe? Does this particular idea have any real connection with reality? I mean, we don't know that there is an 11th dimension. We don't know that these structures really exist. This is a mathematical theory that has a lot of the characteristics that we think we might be able to use to model reality, but we don't know that it actually works. So, in that sense, it's just an idea. At the same time, it is constrained to try to fit what we do know. So, for example, they have this crazy idea, and they make up this force that goes between these brains because they want to make the brains collide. They want them not to just collide once, because they would like to have a universe that is cyclic. Because why? Not because we know it has to be that way, and not because it was written on stone. It was because it's intellectually appealing to have a universe that has always been here. I call it a multiverse because you have the cycles in it, which sort of, you have something that becomes something looking like our universe, and then it disappears in another conflagration, and then it happens again. But it's really a cyclic universe. So it's completely colored by the human element, and it is pulled out of thin air. That's what theorists do. But does it have any real connection with reality? Now you have to ask questions. So first of all, they have to say, can we make this fit what we already know? So that means it has to create something that looks like the Big Bang, and and that means it has to have energy distributed with fluctuations of a certain pattern, and the space-time has to expand and cool down so that you'll get the Big Bang nucleosynthesis ratios of light elements to be right. And then if you've got all that, then it looks like reality. It turns out that the pattern of fluctuations, and there are characteristics a little bit in these fluctuations, which I believe can differ between this model and the inflationary Big Bang models. and people are actually trying to make those measurements. If in the end they find that they find a pattern of fluctuations that agrees with one or the other, then the scientists will sort of swing more toward one or the other and explore that more. So yeah, it's made up, but is it the same as somebody just throwing long words and symbols down paper? No, it's not made up in that way. It's a very coherent set of rules and things that they're following, and it fits sort of physics as we know it as best they can. But in a sense, yeah, they're sort of making it up. I mean, in the 1990s, no one even talked about this stuff. Nobody had that idea before. And so these guys are sitting at a meeting, and somebody was talking about these different stringy structures, like these three brains that could waft around in the bulk. And they're sitting there in the back, and they thought, gee, what happens when they collide? And then they started thinking about, wow, if they collided and they didn't collide all at once and they had this force between them, and out pops this model, which is sort of a cool model, but who knows?
Like all the multi-universe theories, they're all kind of just...
Physics as we... I mean, science as we know it is sort of like that, right? I mean, that's... yeah. To me, it's sort of mind-boggling that it can be as successful as it is and describe such a broad range of very detailed phenomenon. So you get suckered into thinking that you're truly describing reality. Are you? I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
Just describe anything that Big Bang doesn't.
I believe that that the pattern of the energy fluctuations, in the paper that Steinhardt wrote that I assigned for this week, called The Inflationary... I mean, it's about inflation. I think toward the end of that he may talk about what kind of measurement might be made to sort of prove or support inflation versus not. I think there are some differences that Steinhardt probably talks about in his book and I think in this paper. So it could be this whole idea gets killed. I mean, that's true of many of these multiverses. When people eventually do enough measurements, we may be able to distinguish and throw out some of them. So, for example, the idea that has been around for a long time, since Einstein, basically, of an expanding universe that slows down and then comes back and collapses and then goes back, that sort of oscillating universe is one that really is inconsistent with what we know today. So to me, that's one that has become disfavored. So, because we appear to live in a universe where the expansion is actually accelerating with time. So it's not going to slow down and come back and do this, as far as we know. It would take a truly perverse construction of a theory such that it would actually be expanding, accelerating, and then slow down and then come back. That'd be not... And we've never discovered anything strange in the universe before, so why would it happen again? So... Okay? All right. So the way in which all of these extra dimensions can be compactified is something that has come to be called the cosmic landscape or the string theory landscape. So it turns out that the laws of physics that we would perceive, the particle spectrum, the nature of the forces in the string theory, is really determined by how those extra dimensions get compactified in the vacuum. If I had just a box of empty space, if you started out with this 11-dimensional space, how you make six of those dimensions disappear, leaving you the four-dimensional reality in the book, can give you different laws of physics and everything. So it depends on the details of how things are compactified. So what does this really mean? I want to talk about something called the potential energy in the vacuum, or the vacuum energy. And a way to think about that is... Yeah.
Was it in the chapter?
I think. I'll get there. Maybe it'll sound more familiar when I move on a little bit. So, if we have a spring, for example, that's just sitting here, you can say that it has no stored energy because it's not compressed or stretched. But if I compress it a little bit, then it actually has stored energy in it. If I let it go, it can do something, right? If I stretch it, so we have what's known as potential energy, that is energy that is sort of stored in the thing. So the idea is that space has the same sort of thing. We have the same idea of potential energy with gravity. So if I have a book that's on the floor, we might define that to have zero potential energy stored in it. And as I lift it up, I give it energy, because if I let it go, it can drop down and do something. So it has stored energy just by virtue of where it is in terms of height. So that's this idea of potential energy. We can picture a measure of potential energy and how it relates to position by some curve like this. So for example, if we imagine having a ball in a valley, and we look at a measure of the potential energy, the gravitational potential energy of that ball as a function of its position in the valley, at the bottom it would have a minimum of potential energy, and as we move in the valley this way, we have to go up the hill, and up here it would have more potential energy. It would have stored energy here because if we let it go, it'll roll back down here. So there are lots of examples of this in nature, and typically what happens when you have something that has a potential energy of this curve is the system will basically gravitate to where you get to a minimum. Okay? So it turns out that different compactification schemes, the different ways in which you can topologically twist together these six dimensions and make them shrink and disappear, all have different potential energies. So the great hope, the potential energy stored in the vacuum, because we're just talking about space here. So the great hope of the string theorist was that if you looked at all the possibilities of how to twist together these dimensions, that there would be one minimum solution and everything would sort of gravitate to that. And that solution would happen to be the universe in which we live. And that would be the explanation, the theory of everything as to why we sort of have the universe the way that we do. And I depending on how you look at this, I don't want it to come off as some chauvinistic thing. So you could look at this and say, wow, I'm fantasizing about her. Or you could say, she's the one doing the fantasizing. Okay, so at any rate. So we've got the string theory fantasy. The problem is this. Even in real life, in a real valley, for example, if you're rolling this ball around, we were looking at this, and the ball rolls naturally down. But if you live in a real valley, you have little peaks and little local valleys. So if we roll this ball all the way over to here, it's perfectly happy here. And it's called a local minimum. And now, this is the big problem. I'll have to come back to this, I guess, the week after next. But here is the issue, just to pull it all together quickly for you. If you map out all the ways in which you can compactify the space, and you look at the potential energy for each of these configurations as you vary things, there are many local minima. So you cannot have one great minimum that they'll all gravitate toward. So if I were to just have space-time and fluctuate the ways in which I can compactify those extra dimensions, I will get about 10 to the 500 different potentially stable solutions. And these are all the possibilities that one can imagine. And these are different physical laws. These are universes with different physical laws or realities where different things are happening, some of which will be such that inflation will be happening. Others will be stuff that will look very much like our universe. So this idea fits very much into the whole bubble multiverse idea, where we have an inflationary universe, and then you'll have fluctuations in the structure of the compactified space-time, which will cause inflation to stop and create a bubble universe here or here or here. And what's interesting in this is that if you allow this to happen, basically you'll populate all 10 to the 500 different possibilities, among which will be a universe where we could exist, which is why our universe happens to have the physical characteristics that, although you may see them be unusual, they are such that we can be here and observe it. Because that's one of the biggest problems, is our universe seems a bit contrived. How could that possibly happen? And what this picture says is, well, all the possibilities are populated, so of course we'll find ourselves in one where we could exist. And that is how sort of the multiverse confronts the idea of intelligent design. But we'll talk more about that later. Again, in yet another way, anything that could happen has happened in the great multiverse idea. And this one ties together with string theory. So, okay. I have to look at when my official office hours are, but yeah, my intent is to be there for the official ones, and if you want to meet at some other time, just email me and we'll find a time.
Okay.
And I'm happy to try to answer any questions you have during class on Monday as well. So, yeah, it's a lot of weird stuff. I mean, there's... You can do quite well and not be comfortable answering all the questions on the test. I mean, that's not the idea. That it's not. I can't have the expectation where you're really comfortable with everything that's on the test, right?
Okay.